Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to this Council on Foreign Relations conference call. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We are delighted to have Ray Takhe with us today to discuss U.S. policy toward Iran in light of the ongoing nuclear program negotiations and regional security challenges. Dr. Takhe is a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at CFR and adjunct professor at Georgetown University. He is an expert on Iran, political form in the Middle East, and Islamist movements and parties. Prior to joining CFR, Dr. Takhe was senior advisor on Iran at the U.S. Department of State. He is the author of two books on Iran, The Guardians of the Revolution, Iran's Approach to the World, and Hidden Iran, Paradox and Power in the Islamic Republic. Ray, thanks for very much for joining us today. It would be great if you could start us off by talking about the current state of U.S.-Iran relations in light of the negotiations and other considerations.
Thanks. Well, U.S.-Iran relations are always unusual, if not peculiar. Historically, these relations have oscillated between sort of a hysteria of war or the sort of euphoria of reconciliation. I say at this point they seem to be in their usual paradoxical state. Both parties are engaged in negotiations over arms control agreement, and yet both parties insist that that is a very limited form of engagement, and they will continue their competition in the Middle East. They will continue opposition to various other aims that they have. That actually, in many ways, is a sign of a degree of maturity in the relationship, where they can segregate some issues that they can agree on, potentially, like the nuclear issue, while continuing to have their disagreements in the region on a variety of issues, such as the Syrian civil war, the developments in Yemen, the developments in Iraq, and so on. They do seem to be quite close to transacting an agreement over Iran's disputed nuclear program. These negotiations have been taking place now for about 12, 13 years, so they're sort of mature negotiations. And they seem to be arriving at some sort of an agreement, most likely by the deadline, the self-imposed deadline of June 30th. Based upon what is known, as with most such things, it's likely to be an imperfect agreement, and neither side is likely to be satisfied with all aspects of it. The Iranians do get to keep much of their infrastructure in terms of their enrichment capacity, as well as the heavy water plant, but they do have to make some adjustments. They have to reduce the level of centrifuges that they have. They have to reduce the level of enriched uranium that they keep in stock, and they have to modify their heavy water plant to make it less productive and therefore less dangerous. They have to abide by certain intrusive inspection measures and so on. As ostensibly, they will get a substantial measure of sanctions relief, and that is important for their economy. This agreement is likely to come by June 30th, as I mentioned. That is a deadline that has been established. There was a framework agreement that basically established the parameters of the final agreement. That framework agreement was transacted, I think it was in early April. It was a March 30th deadline. These negotiations, as I mentioned, have been going on. This agreement is likely to be very controversial. It's probably one of the most provocative and controversial agreement in the post-Cold War period, in a sense that there's a lot of objections to it, both in the United States and Iran, as well as in the region itself. So how that agreement will unfold, and this has always been one of the complexities of the Iranian nuclear issue, namely that there are so many actors involved. This has never been a bilateral issue between the United States and Iran, but it's been multilateral in a sense that it has involved the European states, Russia and China. It has had audiences beyond those at the negotiating table, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the region, in the United States Congress as well. So that adds to the complexity of the agreement and potentially its durability. We'll see. So at this particular stage, I think the relationship overall has reached a certain stage of maturity and maybe even nuance that has not always been represented in U.S.-Iran relations. The two powers seem to understand that they have to arrive at some agreement on the crucial nuclear issue and also continue the level of disagreements they have on a range of other issues. And so we'll see.
Great. Thank you for that. Don, let's open up to questions from the group.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Again, that was star one. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star two. Please limit your questions to one at a time. Again, to ask a question, please press star one. And our first question comes from Elliot Asidu with University of Nevada, Reno.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for the opportunity, Dr. Taqiyeh. My question is this. So during the tenure of President Ahmadinejad, we witnessed a revolutionary discourse that was not only costly for Iranians, but also it was costly for the regime. So it gave rise to a form of political messianism and granted lots of privileges to IRGC and Basij that some analysts even predicted the rise of a Praetorian system in Iran. So since we see Mr. Rouhani became the president, he was not only successful to reestablish clerical control over the IRGC, but also due to his pragmatism, we might see an agreement over nuclear issue as you suggested. Do you see if Rouhani and his men, given the opportunity, we might see a more collaborative Islamic Republic in other critical regional security issues as well?
I think your description of what has happened is largely correct, and I do agree with it. I don't know if the nuclear agreement will portend cooperation on other issues. The two parties do have some important disagreements in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Bahrain, and so on. And yesterday, or was it the day before, Foreign Minister Zarif, in one of his speeches in New York, suggested that after the nuclear agreement, Iran will focus very much on the region itself and try to essentially figure out how it can contribute to stabilizing the various conflicts in the region. So it's likely to be a more of an area-focused, regional-focused foreign policy, less involved with attempting to reach out to the great powers, in this particular case, the United States. But I suspect they're likely to go to the foreign policy that they had in the 1990s, namely mending fences with the European states, beginning commercial relationships or resuming commercial relationship with those European states, and essentially trying to figure out how to deal, perhaps collaboratively, perhaps competitively, in the region with other stakeholders, Saudi Arabia, Israel, so on. I'm not quite sure in this particular international perspective there is a great degree of sort of a reaching out to the United States involved. However, the two parties do have some similarity of interest. Here I'm particularly thinking, for instance, of ISIS. And that may lead to some tactical cooperation between the two states. But at this particular point, I'm not sure in either capital there's a great degree of impetus for moving beyond the nuclear agreement and toward some form of more fundamental rapprochement. Also, what has to be said, that after this agreement, both the United States and Iran are likely to try to reassure their allies that they have not lost their primary ideological affiliations. The United States will try to sort of convince the Gulf states and others that is committed to the alliance network in the Middle East, and Iran will try to reassure its own stakeholders and its own allies, Hezbollah and others, that it remains a revolutionary state that is unlikely to trade that revolutionary heritage for a normalized relations with the United States. So I suspect afterwards there will be a less degree of U.S.-Iran engagement. That may actually at some point reverse itself, but at this point both parties want to kind of step back to see how the nuclear agreement unfolds, whether it sticks, whether it proves durable, and whether there are openings in the region for them to cooperate, while both being mindful of their allies, which are suspicious of the collaboration that has taken place over the nuclear issue.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again. If you would like to ask a question, please press star one. Our next question comes from Thomas Uthup with Friends of UN Alliance Civilizations.
Hi, Dr. Tucker. Thank you for your expertise on this issue. And I'm wondering, how would you answer those critics who say that this treaty is just a temporary measure to give Iran breathing space for 10 years, 15 years, as the case may be, after which they would resume pursuing a nuclear weapons capability?
Thank well, you. The agreement, as you suggested, does have a sunset clause of 10 to 15 years, whereby most significant restrictions and limitations on Iran's enrichment capacity expire after 10 years. Some restrictions persist for 15 years, have to do with monitoring and compliance issues. And afterwards, Iran is free to pursue an industrial-sized enrichment, with many fear would put it in a position of having a capability of manufacturing a bomb on a short order should it desire. So that's one of the criticisms of the deal, and is an important criticism because, you know, it is a sunsetted agreement. There is no indication that Iran has abandoned the strategic desire for nuclear weapons, and it has kept all options open. This agreement does not foreclose those options. It does delay them. That is one of the criticisms that's made of the agreement, that is likely to be made of the agreement. It is not invalid, nor is it without any sort of a standing. And that's going to be the debate this summer. The administration and its proponents of this agreement will suggest that it does impose some important limitations on Iran for a period of time, and maybe during this period of time, Iran would alter its strategic objectives, and perhaps a different kind of Iran may be born at the end of this agreement. The critics will suggest that this is indeed a sunsetted agreement, and in due course will put Iran in a position, you know, on a platform that it can search through a weapon in a quick manner without undue risk of detection. And, you know, where people stand on that determines where they stand. Where they stand on this debate determines how they view this agreement.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Paul DeVries with New York Divinity School.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Tekka. This may seem a weird question, but in some of the media that talk about this agreement not being spelled out completely in a contract form, but a verbal agreement, is there any truth to that? And what would be the framework that would require something written or verbal?
My guess would be that the final agreement, transacted most likely by June 30th, will be a written text, and all parties will have to agree to that text. And that is the text that the administration has to submit to Congress for review. And if the Corker legislation passes, which it probably will, Congress will have a right to vote up and down on that text. So I don't believe this will be a verbal agreement at the end. I think it will be a text, maybe number of texts, and then everybody will have a chance to evaluate those in both capitals. And as I said, the path that we're on is that the United States Congress will have a right to vote up and down on this agreement within a month after the completion of it.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Richard Joseph with Northwestern University.
Yes. Hello. My question really relates to what was said at the outset about the U.S.-Iran relationship entering a more mature and more nuanced phase. And I wonder if you could say something about what is, you know, an effective alliance between the U.S. and Iran in the current phase of the war in Iraq against the Islamic State. Could you say something about, you know, your sense about that and its implications?
I think the two parties do sense some kind of an agreement in disarming ISIS, but they have pursued their strategy against ISIS largely independent of one another. In some cases, the United States is concerned the way Iran has dealt with ISIS, namely its reliance on Shia militias as opposed to Iraqi National Army. And the fear is that by relying on Shia militias to deal with this radical Sunni movement, it further exacerbated the sectarian divisions in Iraq itself. So even though the two sides agree that ISIS should be disarmed and defeated, they do have different approaches to it. And thus far, they have approached their strategies of dealing with ISIS independently of one another. There perhaps has been some tactical notification, namely if the United States is about to use military force or bomb a certain area, it may notify the Iranians so they don't have any sort of a presence in that while that altercation takes place. But again, this is not unusual in history of U.S.-Iran relations. Overlapping strategic convergence usually doesn't lead to tactical cooperation or presage a larger reconciliation between the two powers. So you can kind of see that playing itself out in Iraq as well, that despite an agreement that both sides share regarding what to do with ISIS, they have approached this issue differently and at times been quite critical of each other's strategies and tactics employed in Iraq against ISIS.
Great. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Charles Stromer with Center for Public Justice. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Charles, your line is now open.
Thank you. Hi. Thanks for taking this call and for being here today on this timely issue. So I've been listening to Foreign Minister Zarif on Charlie Rose the last couple of nights, and, you know, they were talking about typical issues that you might be expect, the real conundrums. But Foreign Minister Zarif kept coming back time and time again, you know, basically saying, look, why is everybody still thinking in the United States about the trust issue vis-a-vis the nuclear deal? We've never wanted, you know, nuclear weapons in the first place. We think it's immoral, against our religion, et cetera, and so on, the typical argument. But he kept, I mean, half a dozen times kept coming back to that, really hammering it home. And it made me think, you know, the way he was really hammering it. I just wondered, do you have any personal views on how much we should trust those kind of statements when they're made so, you know, pretty profoundly by him last night and the other night about the trust issue, that everybody should quit worrying about that? We're not going to have nuclear weapons.
There has always been an absence of trust on both parties, both the United States mistrusting Iran and Iran mistrusting the United States. And that has always been there, given the sort of a history of U.S.-Iran relations, a revolution that took place in Iran in 1979 with this explicit anti-American self-image. So the level of trust between the two parties has always been very limited, if non-existent. And this has made negotiating an arms control agreement difficult, because at the end of the day, an agreement is a living organism. It has to be implemented and enforced every day. And it requires a measure of trust in terms of the other party implementing its agreement and abiding by its verification commitments. And that's always been very difficult, which is why verification of this agreement is likely to be quite hotly debated issue. The United States would want very extensive and intrusive inspection regimes, while Iran may object to the fact that some of those inspection regimes are actually violation of its sovereign territory. And you begin to see how an absence of trust between the two states, it is very difficult to negotiate an agreement, however intrusive its compliance framework may be. And there's always absence of trust on other issues, in terms of Iran's conduct in the region, in terms of Iran's approach to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and so on. And that absence of trust is unlikely to go away. And one of the things that the critics of this agreement fear is precisely the lack of trust in Iranian intentions and motivations, and therefore they tend to believe that Iran cannot be trusted with a substantial enrichment capacity, which it will have after this agreement, and gradual industrialization of that capacity, which it will have as terms of this agreement suggest, namely the expiration of the sunset clause. This is a very serious issue, the absence of trust between the two powers, and that has always militated cooperation between them on a range of other matters. You know, Iranians tend to view American foreign policy through the lens of conspiracy. The Americans tend to view Iran's foreign policy through the lens of their historical grievances and their own mistrust of the revolutionary regime that has yet to lose the character of that revolution, which was anti-American in terms of its character and certainly anti-American in terms of principles that it upheld. So that's always been the case, that which makes this agreement particularly a controversial one.
So I think I hear you saying, even if Iran and the regime in Tehran, it's true that they're not going to ever do nuclear weapons, the distrust level is so high that apparently this deal has something to do with building some confidence in that direction.
I think so, but I don't think that the level of mistrust is going to abate substantially, because both parties tend to be suspicious of each other's motives, and they're both now struggling in a region where they have some serious disagreements with one another. The United States and Iran disagree on what happens in Syria. They obviously disagree on Israeli-Palestinian issues. They even disagree on how Iraq should reconstitute itself. So beyond this sort of a distrust and historical legacy of that distrust, there are some real serious disagreements between the two powers that divide them and contribute to that original mistrust.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Philip Romero with University of Oregon.
Yeah, hi. Hello there. You more or less anticipated my question in one of your earlier answers, but I'd like to give you a chance to expand on that, your comment. When the agreement, when the provisional agreement was announced, I heard criticisms from the right in the U.S. to the general effect that this was another illustration that there's some sort of secret Obama aspiration to co-opt Iran as a stabilizing power within the region. So in essence, the U.S. would begin to cede presence in the Middle East and delegate it to Iran. And the evidence for that was, of course, this agreement as one plank and the tacit cooperation with ISIS, against ISIS, as another. My sense is that you think there's not a lot of evidence for that, but I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on how you read the tea leaves regarding the U.S. Stance towards Iran's position as a responsible actor in the region and what evidence you'll look for going forward.
Both parties, both the United States and the Islamic Republic, deny the fact that they look to this arms control agreement as presaging a larger regional cooperation. So in terms of their public position, they both deny that they have aspirations beyond settling this nuclear issue, which has been damaging to both their interests, both in terms of the United States seeing a gathering nuclear program in Iran, and Iran, of course, because of the economic sanctions that have weakened its economy. Historically, the United States has looked to arms control agreements, has looked as arms control leading perhaps to detente.
Right.
And the argument is, if you can solve a thorny issue like arms control, perhaps there are other areas of selective cooperation. That's not unusual part of the history of American foreign relations. You see it most directly in terms of U.S.-Soviet
right.
relations during the Cold War, or the latter stages of the Cold War in particular. At this particular stage, in terms of what they're saying publicly, both governments deny that that is their aspiration, that they seek to essentially have a detente after an arms control agreement. But I can see some suggestions that perhaps there are issues they can cooperate on, whether it's on ISIS, whether it's on militancy in the region or so on and so forth. I can see the temptation being there. But given the residual mistrust, given how difficult it will be to implement this agreement, given how vociferous the critics of the agreement will be in both capitals, I'm not quite sure if either party is ready to move to that kind of a direction of a sort of a more of a fundamental rationalization of the relationship. But those concerns are there. You hear them in various circles in the United States and even in Iran itself. But I'm not sure in the official quarters, at least what the official quarters are officially saying, is that neither party is looking for a larger reconciliation in the aftermath of this agreement, should it come about.
And just to clarify, regarding actions towards ISIS, I believe you indicate that you don't think there's really any sort of tacit understanding. It's just coincidence.
Well, the two parties do agree that ISIS represents a threat to the Iraqi regime, and they do agree that ISIS should somehow be degraded and destroyed. The question is, how do you do it? And they have different strategies. The United States is hoping to strengthen Iraqi national institutions and national governments in order to deal with the ISIS threat, not to mention its own military deployments. Iran has essentially worked through a lot of Shia militias, and the concern in Washington and elsewhere is that those Shia militias will only exacerbate sort of Sunni disenchantment.
Right.
And the essential basis of ISIS and the rise of ISIS is Sunni disenchantment with what has happened in the Middle East since 2003 with so-called Shia empowerment. So that those concerns are there, and you begin to see how difficult it is to have tactical cooperation over an issue that both parties actually agree on.
Thank you.
Thank you again. If you would like to ask a question, please press *1. Our next question comes from Agon Tolakian with Harvard University.
Good afternoon. This is Agon at Harvard. Would you be kind enough to speak to the impact this agreement will have on the Saudi American relationship as a direct result of this conflict there between the Saudis, obviously, and the Iranians? What is the impact going to be specifically, in your estimation, on the U.S.-Saudi relationship as a result of this agreement?
Well, I think U.S.-Saudi relationship has taken a beating already. There's a lot of concern in Riyadh and elsewhere in Sunni states that United States is not doing enough to deal with empowerment and ascendance of Iran. And they tend to be very suspicious of a nuclear agreement that still leaves Iran with a very substantial enrichment capacity. And as I mentioned, that stipulates that capacity can be industrialized after a decade or so. Those are very much concerns in Saudi Arabia in particular. And also, there's a Saudi-Iranian competition that is playing itself out throughout the region. It's playing itself out in Baghdad, Beirut, Damascus, Syria, and certainly Iraq. So those are concerns. I do think that you begin to see the Saudis reaching out to the Russian Federation, reaching out to the Chinese, and reaching out to others, and essentially even perhaps embarking on their own civilian nuclear program to match the capacity that Iran has. And it should be easy for the Saudis to do because, you know, they have a lot of money and they can purchase nuclear technologies from abroad. As a member of the NPT, they certainly have access and right to have a civilian nuclear program. So one of the unintended consequences of the agreement with Iran is proliferation of nuclear technologies in the region. That's not saying nuclear weapons, but nuclear technologies. And increasingly, the Saudis are beginning to move in their own direction and beginning to be more assertive and more independent and look to alliance with the United States as less reliable bulwark than it has been in the past. That is a very serious issue in U.S.-Saudi relations. Now, I should say, historically, U.S.-Saudi alliance has never been free of rancor and suspicion. I mean, if you look at the history of the Middle East, the Saudis have often protested Americans are being lax and indifferent. They did so in the 1950s. They thought the United States was not sufficiently aware of the threat of Nasserism. In the 1970s, they were very concerned about the rise of the Iranian theocracy that toppled the Shah. And over the years, they have been very concerned about radical republics that have assaulted conservative monarchies such as their own. So the Saudis have always had a degree of unease about the United States and its commitment And the United States, on the other hand, has had its own grievances with the Saudis, namely their sponsorship of radical Islamic movements and essentially feeding the fires of Sunni militancy. It was always an incongruous alliance, sort of a Western democracy and a sort of a Middle Eastern kingdom that rested its legitimacy on a very austere version of Islam. The two parties always had more in common in terms of enemies than in terms of shared values. First, it was the Soviet Union. Then in the 1990s, it was Saddam. Then it was Iran. And now they're beginning to essentially drift apart, where they no longer share the same shared enemies in the same degree of intensity. I do think the Saudi-American alliance will survive this and maybe even revive itself as it has historically. But this is one of the periods where the alliance does seem to be at one of its lower points. And the Saudis are taking many more independent actions. And I suspect among those independent actions they will take is try to construct a civilian nuclear program that matches the capabilities on the other side of the Gulf.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you again. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from George Moffitt with Council on Foreign Relations.
Thank you. Much of this seems to come down to the administration's calculated hope that 10 years from now, the nature of the Iranian regime, maybe the Iranian state, might be sufficiently different that there will be higher levels of trust and cooperation. Does that seem like a reasonable hope to you or not?
I think you're quite right to suggest that the hope is that in 10 years things will look different, and sort of Iran that has more integration into the global economy and so on will see less need to embark on the industrialized program, even when it has those rights and restrictions have expired. It's very difficult to see 10 years ahead and to see what kind of Islamic Republic emerges. Most likely during the next 10 years, the Islamic Republic will go through some sort of a transition in terms of its leadership, with the supreme leader and others leaving the stage. Those who were present at the creation of the revolution leaving the stage, and maybe a succeeding generation taking over. You can never predict the direction of Iranian politics, and if you do, you're likely to be wrong. My guess is that there is one of the interesting things about the Islamic Republic. It is not similar to other revolutionary states. In the West, when we think of revolutionary states, our model or prototype for assessing revolutionary states has always been China. We kind of think about revolutionary states operating and going through the same evolution that the Chinese did. You know, they have a sort of a radical phase, and then they gradually move beyond their ideological commitments and become a more of a state that trades its ideological patrimony for sake of global economic integration. The interesting part about the Islamic Republic is it hasn't gone through this trajectory. There are certain revolutionary values that it maintains, that it upholds, that it endures. And I suspect it will always be, in that sense, a state that refuses to relinquish its revolutionary ideological heritage and legacy. It will always have that revisionist tendency. So in that sense, it's not going to look like China going through that trajectory, that evolution. It's not going to look like Vietnam that has gone through a similar trajectory and evolution. It's likely to be a state that never transcends the original revolution that launched the republic.
Ray, does the conflict in Yemen complicate the ongoing nuclear program negotiations?
I think both parties are trying to keep the negotiations on the nuclear issue segregated from an entire spectrum of their disagreements. That's hard to do because those disagreements are substantial and mounting. But I think at this particular point, they're both trying to resist Yemen or Syria or what have you intruding on the nuclear negotiations, which they seem to think are making substantial progress. But again, this is the problem with trying to have an arms control policy at the time when the two sides are in different sides of the region, because that arms control policy is kind of viewed in a certain context. And the context today is a region where the United States and Iran are often at disagreement.
Great, thank you.
Again, if you would like to ask a question for our speaker, please press star 1 and you can have your questions answered immediately. Again, that was star 1. Our next question comes from Kathy Ward, not available.
Yeah, hi. So this is off topic a little bit, but since Yemen just got mentioned, I was just wondering what's your thinking on the way the U.S. military reacted by sending a whole carrier group to respond to these ships coming from Iran towards Yemen. Do you think that was an effective response, or are there things you would have done differently?
Well, I think you'll see more such responses like that. Part of the reason why there was such a robust American military deployment, it has less to do with Yemen, but as a means of reassuring the allies in the Gulf, namely that the United States still is committed to its alliances in the Gulf, irrespective of the nuclear negotiation. It is still committed to resisting Iran in the Gulf, irrespective of the nuclear negotiations. So that military deployment can be seen, as robust as it was, as an indication of American commitment, and less viewed as a sort of a logistical challenge that it had to overcome. That's not unusual. In the Middle East, the United States often has deployed military forces less in terms of solving a military problem than as a gesture of confidence-building measure to its allies. Eisenhower did that in 1958 when he deployed American forces in Lebanon. They had very limited impact on what was taking place in Lebanon, but it was a means of providing confidence and assurance to the Saudis, the Jordanians, and others who were concerned about the rise of Nasserism and radicalism in aftermath of the Iraqi Revolution of 1958. This has been a recurring character of American policy in the Middle East, whereby military deployments are meant to convey a certain impression of American commitment and are less relevant to the actual military task that they have to perform.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Cecil Phillips with Place Properties.
Thank you very much. My question concerns an interpretation of the agreement regarding sanctions. Is it your reading of the agreement that all of the sanctions from the EU and all the U.S. sanctions, other than those imposed by Congress, will be removed simultaneously with the execution of the agreement or in phases? And what is your interpretation of so-called snapback provisions? Can they possibly be effective?
In terms of sanctions relief, the issue is the agreement between the two powers is a little more apparent than sometimes it is suggested. When they're talking about sanctions relief, they're talking about a number of things. They're talking about lifting of the European Union sanctions that were imposed in 2010, whereby the European Union stopped purchasing Iranian oil. So that's about 800,000 to 1 million barrels. They're talking about financial sanctions that were imposed by presidential authority, but also work because of European compliance, whereby Iran is not capable of engaging in transactions in the financial markets using things like SWIFT, which essentially help repatriate money from abroad and so on. They're talking about the fact that Iran has about $120 billion sitting in banks in China and in India. It has access to those funds if it wants to spend them in China, India, South Korea, but it cannot repatriate those funds, so it is likely to be able to do so under this agreement. So all these particular sanctions are likely to be abrogated and waived by the Europeans and the others and waived by the president. Now the question is when. The agreement that is going to be signed on June 30th requires Iran to do certain things. For instance, Iran has to dismantle number of centrifuges. It has to remodify the Arak heavy water plant. And the United States estimate that takes Iran to come into compliance with that agreement, maybe about 6 months, 7 months, whatever. And it is America's position that first Iran has to make those adjustments in order to comply with this final agreement, and then the sanctions relief that I talked about would take place. The Iranian position is once they signed an agreement, those sanctions relief have to come about. So it is the signature of agreement that has to provoke sanctions relief, not the implementation of the agreement. Now, we're talking here about 6-7 months, and I'm sure there are a lot of people trying to work this out, and I think in some way it's going to work out. So the notion of sanctions relief is not as insurmountable of an obstacle that is sometimes thought about. Now, on the issue of snapback sanctions, you know, legally, you can probably snap sanctions back, but in practice, my guess is once commerce returns to Iran, it'll be very difficult to turn that off. So I'm not quite sure if the sanctions are likely to be snapped back in the same way that people are thinking about them. It took a long time and a lot of effort and a lot of Iranian truculence to get the sanctions architecture in place. And I think in aftermath, as the architecture begins to be dismantled, it'll be very difficult to reconstitute it, irrespective of the legal authority for snapback that may be negotiated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dan Caldwell with Pepperdine University.
Given the apparent ambivalence of the Ayatollah to the agreement and the outright opposition of many in the Congress, what do you think is the probability that an agreement will actually come into force?
Well, I think the agreement, once it is signed, will come into force at least a period of time. And the hope in various official circles is that everybody who is skeptical of the agreement, whether in Tehran or in Washington or in Paris or elsewhere, once they see the agreement being implemented, and once the agreement becomes not just a text, but as I said, a living organism, then it is likely to garner constituencies. Once this sort of things take place, once the agreement has a record and has some sort of a tangible benefits behind it, it is likely to get support from, or at least tacit acquiescence from, those that are skeptical of it or downright opposed to it today. That's the theory of the case. I don't know how it's going to work. As I said, this agreement comes at a time when there are many influential voices in the United States who are concerned about it, and those voices are not just in the Republican Party, but you see many Democratic legislatures also being very concerned about it. Something is too permissive in terms of technological concessions that it makes. Others are concerned about the sunset clause. Others are concerned about things that are not in the agreement, such as Iran's ballistic missile inventory, such as the fact that the agreement does not ask Iran to disclose its previous military activities in the nuclear realm. So, you know, those who are negotiating the agreement hope that once it is implemented, once it becomes a living organism and not just words on text, that it will garner constituencies or at least propitiate those who are concerned about it. We'll see how that works in practice. I tend to be skeptical of that view, but we'll see.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from John Hartley with Yale University.
Hi, thank you for this time. My main question relates to Iranian domestic politics. When you look at the domestic political struggles that have been alluded to, what are the dynamics, the one or two pieces of the puzzle that seem most significant to successful implementation of an eventual agreement, or gradual increasing of confidence that in the region that Iran will be a responsible actor, quote-unquote?
Well, right now, in terms of the Iranian domestic politics, to be very simplistic about it, it's the right, the center, and the left. I mean, you couldn't be more simplistic than that. Over the past, since 2009 contested presidential election, what we have seen is the steady destruction of the left. And the left wing of the Iranian body politic was always the political tendency that was most interested in coming to terms with the international community, with adhering to its international legal obligations, the reform wing of the Iranian body politic, if you would. The demise of that wing of the Iranian political system, I think, augurs poorly for the notion that Iran can be a responsible stakeholder in the region or at home in terms of civil society, legal protection of dissent, and so forth.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you again. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Michael Sahir with Nur Allah Islamic Center.
Yeah, thank you for taking my question. I was wanted to ask, are there going to be any human rights or issues that would be associated with the agreement?
In short, no. The human rights has been an issue that's been neglected by the administration for a very long time. And the human rights situation in Iran during the past couple of years has gotten worse in terms of prosecution of dissent, in terms of closure of press outlet, in terms of sheer number of executions. Not all those executions are obviously politically motivated, but nevertheless, Iran today stands as, I believe, has surpassed China as the leading executions per capita. The human rights situation in Iran is glaringly bad, and you see this in reports by the United Nations, you see this by reports by other human rights groups, and that issue has been largely neglected. It has been the assumption of the United States government, and I think a wrong assumption, that by insisting on human rights, they will jeopardize the possibility of getting an arms control agreement. That has been the assumption of the United States government. I think it's wrong. And I think we have been too passive in criticizing very substantial human rights abuses that the Islamic Republic engages in. It is important to note that when the Islamic Republic violates human rights standards, it not only violates international law, it violates its own domestic law. And that's something that too many people have been reluctant to bring up so long as nuclear negotiations have been taking place. They've been inordinately concerned about sensitivities of the Islamic Republic. As I mentioned, I think that's been one of the flaws of how this administration has approached this issue.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions?
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. We have no further questions at this time.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Ray. I don't know if there were any closing comments that you want to make before we wrap up.
I know. I'm fine. Thanks.
Great. It was a really informative session. Thank you very much. And thanks to all of you for your questions and contributions to the discussion. As a reminder, the audio will be available on our website at cfr.org if you want to share it with your colleagues. We encourage you to check out the website, cfr.org, as well as foreignaffairs.com. We just launched a redesigned website for Foreign Affairs, so I hope that you will go there and look at it. And for those of you who participate in our Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative, please follow us on Twitter at CFR_religion for announcements about upcoming events and information about the latest CFR resources that are designed for the religious community. So thank you again. Thank you to Ray Take, and look forward to your participation in future discussions.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.